When you hear Gavin say something like he expects a lot of the early adopters will be disappointed in the future because Bitcoin will inevitably lose some of its decentralization as it scales up. And, you know, for him to just accept that, I mean, that's just a different set of values than what I have. You know, it's not necessarily like one's right or one's wrong, but he's not designing the same kind of system I'm interested in designing in.
Hello, welcome to episode 34 of The Bitcoin Game. I'm Rob Mitchell, and today my guest is Bitcoin core developer Peter Todd. I have to admit, I'm really happy how much I learned about Peter in our interview. He was really open about everything from his relationship with Gavin Andreessen to mistakes he made in his early days working with Bitcoin Core, and a dozen or so topics in between. A lot of Peter's focus was on explaining what he feels are the differences between Bitcoin Core and Bitcoin Classic. Of course, Peter gives plenty of reasoning why Core is the path to follow at this juncture. I hope you enjoy this episode of The Bitcoin Game with Peter Todd. Hello, Peter.
Hey.
Hey, it's Rob Mitchell. Thanks so much for taking time to talk to me.
No worries.
I know all about you from news and stuff, but I didn't Google you to find out where you were born and stuff because I like to just kind of have a organic interview. So I am really curious, what were you doing before you got into Bitcoin?
I was actually an analog electronics designer at a geophysics startup, which is kind of funny because I guess you could go say I was working in the kind of mining that involves geologists rather than proof of work.
That is funny. I'm curious to find out more. An analog circuit designer, is that what you said?
Analog electronics designer.
So what does that mean?
So basically what we were building at that company was essentially a new type of gravity sensor. And long story short is the way you actually measure gravity is deep in a container full of liquid helium with squid sensors and all this fun stuff. And the big thing being, of course, something's actually got an interface between that analog world and the digital world. So I was the guy who actually designed the electronics that kind of went in between the two and converted the essentially converted the analog signals to digital. So it's all, you know, very kind of old tech, if you will. It's kind of more stable than, say, Bitcoin. I mean, in my entire, 6 years working in that field, I couldn't name you a single thing that had changed in the whole time. And I remember at one point, you know, working from textbooks from the 1920s for one of my designs. Is there, you know, just as up to date as anything else, so...
That's fascinating. I feel like I have no idea how any of that works. It just sounds fascinating. Did you experiment with any other interfaces just kind of for fun besides the gravity sensor?
Well, I mean, that project was pretty complex, and I wound up doing a whole pile of stuff for that. You know, everything from, squid sensors to all kinds of monitoring stuff with power supplies and batteries, et cetera, et cetera.
What is a squid sensor?
If you know what an MRI machine is, it's the same kind of thing that actually measures the magnetic fields. If I remember my acronym correctly, it stands for like superconducting quantum interference device. Essentially, you know, it just measures magnetic fields very accurately.
Interesting. I would not have thought magnetic fields were part of gravitational sensors.
It's interesting thing about gravity is it doesn't influence anything other than mass. So the way you actually measure it is you literally get a test mass, you know, which is a block of material, and you see how it moves in relation to the gravitational force. So literally what we were actually doing is the test mass happened to be superconducting, which means that you have a trapped magnetic field in it. And then as it moves relative to its container, you measure essentially the magnetic field interacting with a coil, you know, and that pushes electrons, which then you can couple to another coil and measure the magnetic field there in a different part of the device. So it's all quite neat.
It is. I find that fascinating. What were you doing before you got this job?
My background there before that was I was in the middle of a fine arts degree.
Surprise.
Yeah. Well, most of my art was, you know, very electronics and programming heavy. And in high school, I did a specialized computer science program. And, you know, when I was also at my previous job, I was doing a physics degree as well. So, you know, it all makes a bit more sense than it might sound at first. And, you know, I kind of had the right back to go learn new things. So,
is your art visible anywhere on the web?
Not sure it is anymore. It's been quite a few years since I last had it up on my website.
Do you still have the art?
Not much of it, actually. I end up selling nearly all of it in various shows.
Well, I hope you got a lot, because I think you'd get a lot now.
Yeah, it's well, let's just say Bitcoin pays a little better. Not that much better, but a bit better.
Well, let me ask you that. What pays you in Bitcoin? I don't even know really how you make a living and how much is from Bitcoin. Or
It's basically 100% from Bitcoin-related businesses right now. I mean, legally speaking, I'm CEO of 8930511 Canada Limited. Kind of just rolls off the tongue. And you know, I do consulting for various clients. Lately, a lot of it's been people kind of looking to go sort of research new things, you know, come up with kind of new stuff you could do with consensus, as well as, you know, work on Bitcoin Core for various projects. One of the things I'm actually was working on earlier today was taking essentially the same concepts behind Bitcoin scripts and then reapplying that in other parts of crypto. Like, if you know about PGP, you know, you could imagine a PGP key having the same kind of capabilities as a Bitcoin script does in terms of multi-sig and delegation and so on. So
everything you say, I just have a million questions. Let me back up before we go too far. What got you interested in Bitcoin?
Well, I mean, I've got an email in my inbox, you know, I sent to a friend at like late 2009. So somehow or another, I must have found the white paper. But, you know, all the way back in high school, I got interested in the Freenet project, which is kind of this decentralized DHT-based data publication platform.
And what is DHT?
Oh, a distributed hash table.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So the idea is you have a key space and you kind of spread that out over many different machines. And, you know, that was being used as a data publishing platform. But of course, if you're going to have published data, I mean, surely you can somehow decentralize money. And I remember reading Adam Back's Hashcash paper pretty much around when it came out and thinking, you know, there's got to be some way to turn this into an actual usable currency. So I spent quite a bit of time trying to figure that out and never quite succeeded.
That's interesting that I did not know you were thinking about these things well before Bitcoin.
I'd entirely forgotten, but some stalker went and pulled up old emails that had actually been sending between myself and Adam Back and Hal Finney on one of these old mailing lists back when I was about 15 or 16. You know, apparently back then I was actually talking to these guys about these various concepts.
Wow. I feel like you could have a whole conversation on these older days. Are any of the other prominent people in Bitcoin people you remember communicating with back then?
No, absolutely no one. I mean, I'd entirely forgotten. I was exchanging emails with Adam Back. I had absolutely no memory of it till I dredged this up again and thought, oh, hang on, of course, yeah, that's who I was talking to. At the time, like, I didn't really know who these people were.
Uh-huh.
You know, I had no idea that, you know, this would actually become something more important later. You know, all I knew was I'd read some cool paper by this guy Adam Back, and I was talking to him on some email form. At the time, it didn't seem very remarkable.
Yeah, no, that's cool. It's nice of someone to dig that up for you, too, and remind you. When did you start developing for Bitcoin Core?
I think it would have been around 2012 or so. I remember my first actual Git commit that got accepted was to fix a spelling mistake. After that, you know, most of my initial stuff was more looking at the design of the system and trying to understand it better and figure out improvements that could be made. You know, I think overall, I haven't actually done too many, you know, compared to like, especially like Peter Wool, for instance, haven't made too many actual code contributions in terms of the number of lines. But, you know, most of my work's been about better understanding the system and making very targeted changes. I mean, I think the big kind of turning point for me was really getting involved in the block size debate.
I guess we can just get into it. How would you describe the current attempt to fork Bitcoin to Bitcoin Classic?
Well, you know, I think you've got a group of developers with a very different view of how Bitcoin works and what the goals of the projects are. You know, I think that's inevitably going to lead to a lot of friction.
I'd love to hear you specifically say what you think the differences are in, I guess, the technical understanding risks and goals between Bitcoin Core and Bitcoin Classic as you see them.
Well, you know, Gavin, for instance, made some fairly clear statements about this. You know, for instance, he, you know, has viewed for quite a long time, based on what he's written, that it is acceptable if, you know, as Bitcoin grows, the number of people who actually run full nodes and are actually in control of the system, who are actually checking that the system works, you know, stays constant or decreases. You know, he expects
people to go make that trade-off where, you know, in exchange for having a system that's cheaper, you have a system that's more centralized. And I think the real difference is that the Bitcoin core devs, you know, they understand that these trade-offs are going to happen, at least with current technology, but they're willing to put the trade-offs in different places. I would much rather have the trade-off be that the Bitcoin blockchain layer, the very lowest level, that stays highly decentralized. You know, it may get more expensive to use directly, but you counterbalance that by putting the inevitable centralization at a higher level. You know, the Lightning Network isn't quite the model of Bitcoin. It's not quite the send money to anyone instantly. You have this kind of mesh that's relatively complex of people who are somewhat trusted to go not, you know, hold money. Now, we fortunately get to use a whole lot of essentially smart contracts to reduce that risk. But, you know, compared to a hypothetical Bitcoin of unlimited capacity, it's certainly, you know, a step backwards. On the other hand, that Bitcoin doesn't exist yet. We got to make the trade-off somewhere. And I think Gavin's a lot happier to make the trade-off at the lowest level. Whereas I'd point out, making that trade-off means that you can't compete against systems that are much more centralized at that level.
Do you actually feel that 2 megabyte max block size will technically, oven in itself, cause issues? Or are you just thinking the path and leanings of Gavin are the problem?
Currently, the debate isn't about the 2 megabytes. You know, Bitcoin Core is also proposing a roughly 2 megabyte block size increase implemented through segregated witnesses. Either way, you know, we're willing to make the trade-off to increase bandwidth and, you know, risk that centralization to get a temporary bump. I think the question you really got to ask is, A, what is actual details of what Gavin's proposing, you know, what Bitcoin Classic is proposing, and B, what's the next step? Gavin's already said publicly, you know, that he expects we'll probably need another hard fork in maybe another 12 months to increase the block size yet again. What's the long-term plan there, you know? And I'm just not seeing that kind of acceptance from that Classic team that, you know, there are limits to the system and we can't scale up indefinitely. So, you know, what's your long-term plan? Whereas I think Bitcoin Core has been much more focused on enabling solutions that would be a fit on top of the Bitcoin layer. So we don't have to make that hard trade, you know, hard decision yet again in another 12 months.
Is your position pretty much that enabling segregated witness would get us by for the next year or two as opposed to a block size increase?
Well, I mean, it is a block size increase with the current Bitcoin Core scaling proposal.
Oh, okay. So it's both. Okay.
Yeah. And keep in mind, I mean, that's a compromise. You know, segregated witnesses is not something that was actually originally proposed as a block size increase. Segregated witnesses was originally proposed as a fix to get rid of transaction mutability, which we need to do for a lot of reasons. And the fact that it could also be a block size increase is essentially an accident of implementation. You know, and given that I think there was, you know, reasonably wide consensus that we needed to do a temporary increase to give companies more time to adapt to how you'd use Bitcoin in the future, I think Bitcoin Core team was happy to say, all right, you know, let's also do a minor block size increase this way. We'll do it quite safely with a soft fork. And, you know, that'll give companies time to transition.
What exactly do you see as the timeline for segregated witness, block size increase, and whatever the visibility is for the core team?
You know, the rough deadline of doing a release around April or so, it's, you know, certainly a tight deadline, but it's not impossible. You know, and from that, then as wallets add support to it, essentially every wallet that adds support gets cheaper transactions because their transactions get to take advantage of this extra space that segregated witnesses enables. And then also immediately once it's deployed on the network, that then also allows you to start deploying things that make use of this anti-malleability functionality on mainnet. You know, from point of release, the time it actually goes live, you know, you're probably looking at maybe 2-3 months.
Okay.
So, you know, it's not implausible to think it could be ready by, say, the end of the summer in terms of actually, you know, enabled on the network, you know, with some wallets supporting it. But like I say, I mean, if you then need another increase after that, well, you know, we have no options other than just doing a hard fork. I mean, you got to ask, if you need to keep doing this, where's Bitcoin going? I mean, the system doesn't scale and you just have to accept that and do something smarter. You know, every time you do an increase, you're making the system more centralized.
And you either counterbalance that with improvements in tech, you know, improvements in algorithms and so on, or you don't do that and you improve, you know, the system in some other way. And currently, I mean, we've done an incredible amount of work to get to the point where we are right now. I mean, frankly, Bitcoin, you know, 0.1 as released could not handle 1 megabyte blocks. You know, it's just too slow, too inefficient. So there's been about, you know, 100-fold performance increase to get to this point to then handle 1 megabyte blocks. To go think that you can do that again, that's pretty dubious.
I recently hired Joe Looney, one of the active developers in the Let's Talk Bitcoin ecosystem, to create some code that allows one to enter a Bitcoin amount and a date and get a US dollar value result. It's perhaps the easiest way to look up the US dollar value of a past Bitcoin transaction. If this sounds useful to you, give it a try at bitcoinhistoricprice.com. And please let me know if you have any feedback.
The larger the block size, the harder it is to go mine, particularly with small players, and the harder it is to run a full node.
So I guess basically a core belief of yours is that people wanting to increase the block size are really underestimating this effect, or you think they just don't care?
I just think, you know, they have different values. You know, when you hear Gavin say something like he expects a lot of the early adopters will be disappointed in the future because Bitcoin will inevitably lose some of its decentralization as it scales up. And, you know, for him to just accept that, I mean, that's just a different set of values than what I have. You know, it's not necessarily like one's right or one's wrong, but he's not designing the same kind of system I'm interested in designing in. He doesn't necessarily think that proof of work will be what secures Bitcoin in the future. You know, again, I mean, it's another one of those things where, yeah, I mean, I could imagine, say, a consortium of companies getting together and signing the blockchain, but that's not the type of system I'm interested in working on.
So somehow I missed that quote. That seems like a pretty big thing to say, that it won't be proof of work in the future. When did he say that?
I should go dig that up. I believe it was around 2011 or 2012, maybe.
A long time ago. Well, Google can help. I'll check it out and see if I can find it.
You also got to wonder, I mean, just in general, you know, if you end up in a system where only a relatively small number of people can mine profitably, then what really stops that from just saying, you know what, screw this proof of work thing. Why don't we just start signing blocks and call it a day? You know, you can imagine it transitioning like that.
Yeah, it's just such a change. I just can't. It's such a complex mechanism, all of Bitcoin and all the players, that I can't even imagine what happens.
I actually think you can explain why this happens fairly easy. This is actually one of my very early results, and I think one of my major contributions to this space, which is if you imagine a system with, say, three miners, right? Suppose, you know, you're a miner, I'm a miner, and we have one third party, Alice. If I go find a block, once I distribute that block to one more person, and, you know, let's suppose we all have equal one third of hashing power, the moment I'm over 50%, it's definitely true that on average, if that block doesn't actually get to the third person, you know, the other 33%, well, the 66%, you know, the majority who have that block, they're going to get further, they're going to make an even longer chain, and essentially their block will win. And what that really means from the perspective of the people who don't yet have that block is they're wasting their time, because any block they find is going to get orphaned by the majority, because after all, why would the majority build on their block rather than their own block? After that 50%, what incentive does the majority have to go help out the minority who have slow internet connections? The reality is they don't. They actually earn more money, both in transaction fees immediately and also subsidy after the difficulty resets, by making larger blocks, not smaller blocks. You know, and they do this essentially because they're screwing over their competitors. And as it turns out, I originally thought the threshold was 50%, but when you do the math properly, you actually realize it's about 30%. So in essence, you know, once I can get my block to about 30% of the hashing power, I don't actually have an incentive to get it to more of the hashing power. You know, this is a really serious problem because, well, if I'm that guy with a small amount of hashing power, you know, even if my internet connection is the same size, or, you know, same speed as everyone else, I'm still earning less money. And naturally, my incentive will be, all right, take my hashing power and point it at the largest pool. You know, and you run through a couple rounds of this, especially given that mining is a very cutthroat business, you know, I think we have potential for very serious problems. We're already seeing that in the current mining field, where large concentrations of hashing power are earning more money because of this effect. So the block size limit at least puts a cap on how important this effect is. But as you keep increasing it, this problem gets worse and worse. Although, interestingly, you know, Gavin disagrees there. And I think that kind of comes down to different view of what Bitcoin is. You know, he disagrees because, as far as I can tell, he thinks miners will be honest and they will help out other miners for the good of the system. Whereas I would argue, you know, that's a very nebulous kind of guarantee to assume. And that would be very easy to be wrong there if, you know, all that has happened is people notice, hang on a second, I'll earn a little more money if I screw over my competitors. I mean, it's easy to imagine people doing this.
Let me ask you, I mean, you brought up that it is a problem now already. I mean, say we don't increase the block size, how do we try to keep mining from being too centralized going forward?
You have to make running full nodes easier and cheaper. You know, and frankly, you know, by doing a 2 megabyte block size increase, be it with segregated witnesses or hard fork, you know, you're going in the opposite direction there. Like I say, this is a compromise. You know, it's not one that I think many people in Bitcoin Core are very happy with. But, you know, if enough of the community needs that, then maybe it's one worth making. But, you know, to say that we're going to just do this again willy-nilly, I mean, I can't really agree with that. You know, and I think the longer-term direction of Bitcoin Classic there isn't a good idea.
But again, I'm just really curious, say... Well, I mean, what are your ideas on how to deal with the mining problem that exists and maybe, as you're asserting, will exist to a bigger extent once the block size increases? Is there a way to code a solution to that?
You really have to improve the underlying tech. Partly, you know, faster internet bandwidth in general helps. Although, you know, usually that's constrained by politics, not technology. And, you know, there are some things that have some promise, like faster block propagation. The problem is most of those things only work if people cooperate. You know, for instance, IBLT, which Gavin, you know, has promoted quite a bit, and now Blockstream's Rusty is working on it as well. You know, that allows miners who cooperate to distribute blocks around the network a lot faster. You know, makes some of these issues less important. But that only works between miners who cooperate. You know, miners who don't want to cooperate, they still have the ability of deliberately making blocks that are slow for their competitors to get. And a lot of this stuff's very hard. I mean, me personally, I've done a lot of research on, you know, how to go shard the blockchain, split it up across different miners. How do you have multiple miners collaborate to work together? You know, you've probably heard of my tree chains research, for instance. But a lot of this stuff's relatively far away. And, you know, I think we've got a long road ahead of us to get there. So, you know, kind of hard to go say what'll happen there.
For the fork to go to Classic, 75% of mining has to switch to their implementation?
Well, I mean, this is an interesting thing. And I think this is the second thing which the Bitcoin Core team in general strongly disagrees with Gavin on, is that, you know, by setting a threshold of 75%, well, what happens to the 25%? They aren't necessarily going to agree that Bitcoin Classic is a good idea. You know, they can very well go with something else. You know, for instance, the status quo, segregated witnesses, whatever. And the problem is, in a hard fork, you have the potential for having two chains afterwards. And with, you know, 75-25% split, which in reality in the Bitcoin Classic implementation can actually be 50-50 for that matter, both chains work. You know, when I say work, I mean the simple technical fact of, can I send money from point A to point B on the chain? And if I can do that on both sides, well, now I can have a functioning economy on both sides. Most likely thing that happened there is trading. You know, and when you have two chains, well, they are two separate currencies. You know, you'll probably end up with a price between the two. You know, I've personally spoken to some exchanges who've confirmed that, you know, their legal opinion they've gotten is that if you have two chains that from a technical point of view work, you have two different currencies. And chances are they're going to be forced to, for instance, let their clients withdraw the two currencies separately. Because after all, you know, that's two separate currencies. I mean, why wouldn't, you know, I be allowed to go and withdraw the thing that I'm holding? And, you know, if this scenario happens, it'll be worth quite a bit of money on either side. So, you know, if you're an exchange, you'd probably rather just give your customers what they may want, which is both sides of the currency, rather than risking a lawsuit.
People on the other side of the argument claim just economically the smaller side will very quickly kind of capitulate to not be on the, I guess, a smaller branch.
Well, I think the problem is we don't know. This was briefly discussed on the Bitcoin Dev mailing list, and I remember seeing Alex Morcos, you know, essentially call out Gavin saying, you know, the fact that you're saying this so confidently, you know, is very misleading. I mean, nobody really knows. You know, what we do know is that there's definitely millions of dollars on the Bitcoin Core side, you know, of people who've put up signed Bitcoin statements backed by actual Bitcoins saying, you know, I agree that if this controversial fork happens, you know, people would go sell their Bitcoins, crash the price, whatever, you know. That's suggestive. At least it shows that there's a lot of money out there, people who may be pissed off.
People are saying they're going to tank the price if we switch to Classic?
Well,
is that what you just said, basically?
So there's this website called Bitcoinocracy. It's a rather obscure website, but in spite of how obscure it is, you know, I mean, last I checked, there was something like, you know, $15 million worth of Bitcoin, essentially voting, saying, you know, if you have a controversial fork, we expect large Bitcoin holders to go and sell and tank the price on, you know, the side that they don't like. I mean, and, you know, I mean, you don't know. $15 million in the context of a few billion, it's not necessarily that much money, but it's suggestive. You know, the fact that you have people with that much money making this claim that they're not happy about this, it's certainly suggestive that this could happen. And, you know, when you're working with billions of dollars, I mean, you don't take risks lightly.
What if these are all Bitcoin Core devs posting these things? I mean, we don't know who any of these people are, right?
I mean, you can't know.
I'm not saying it is, but...
In either way, I mean, the fact is you've got that much money on a very obscure website that chances are very few people actually know about, you know, making this kind of statement. I mean, this certainly shows that we don't have strong consensus. Look at the miners who've gone and said, you know, we're calling for consensus. You know, we're not going to run Bitcoin XT or Bitcoin Classic right now. You know, that represents, I think, last issue, something like 60-70% of the hashing power. I mean, right there, that's enough to say, you know, this Bitcoin Classic plan is probably not going to happen that way.
Are you imagining you're going to, I guess you said, make these concessions and maybe April or May start releasing a core version that you think will be the path that brings consensus?
Keep in mind, I mean, something many people, including myself, have been telling Gavin to do is, you know, if this isn't getting consensus, I mean, obviously the 75% threshold can lead to some pretty major problems if you don't actually get consensus. So why don't you just release it with a higher threshold? I mean, I may not necessarily agree with where it's going, you know, what the change is, but you know, if we, for instance, had 99% of the hashing power agreeing to a hard fork, well, what happens to 1% chain? 1% hashing power basically means you get a confirmation every 16 hours or so. You know, that's not a viable chain. That's not a chain that's going to develop a separate economy. You know, if you're in a circumstance where you've actually had that much hashing power supporting something, chances are it'll proceed pretty smoothly. And, you know, you're not going to run into major problems like this. Now, you know, Gavin's viewpoint on that is, well, he doesn't want one big pool to be able to hold up the change. Well, you know, if you're willing to go through with something like this, even though you have a, you know, quarter of the hashing power disagreeing with you, you're disenfranchising a lot of people. You know, you're telling a lot of people, we don't care about your thoughts. We're not going to try to compromise with you. We're just going to go ahead with this. You know, in a system that needs consensus, I mean, that's a pretty dangerous thing to be doing. You know, whereas if you go focus on, well, let's go build consensus, let's find something everyone can agree with, that's much more likely to go work out. You know, you're never going to get 100%, but, you know, 95%, 99%, that's a heck of a lot safer than having a quarter of all hashing power potentially disagreeing with you. Particularly when, you know, the way Bitcoin Classic is actually implemented, it can end up being 50-50. I mean, the moment you get 75%, well, it can actually drop after that, and the hard fork still happens.
Is there a reason it would drop, though, that you can think of, a scenario that makes sense for it to drop?
Well, I mean, for instance, if you have some hashing power, you might actually want it to activate temporarily and then make it immediately drop to call into question the whole fork. You know, for instance, if you got to the 75% threshold and then, you know, 15% suddenly dropped off and, you know, leaving you at 60%, that's a really dangerous hard fork to go through with. And you'd probably end up having the remaining 60% say, you know what, this is too dangerous, we're going to go back to Bitcoin Core, and you have to restart the whole process again.
I feel like if anything like this happened, that would be a pretty tumultuous time for Bitcoin.
Yeah. You know, and again, I mean, it's not sure what's going to happen. So to be taking a risk like that, really, you know, I mean, I wouldn't want to do it, not with billions of dollars on the line. You know, and I think Gavin's willing to take much bigger risks than most people.
What about just the risks of a whole bunch of new code and segregated witness? I mean, there are some risks with so much new code, right?
Well, I mean, keep in mind, segregated witness is something we want to do anyway. You know, we do need this change for Bitcoin. You know, I think you do have an extra risk in that it's probably getting pushed through faster than otherwise would be. But, you know, the change itself is actually surprisingly small. You know, it's interesting how BAP 101, it actually had more lines of code change than segregated witnesses did for the first version.
You hear about an update exposing some older bug, or maybe there's just something about the complex ecosystem with the wallets that, I don't know, could have a result no one thought about. I mean,
you know, when you start arguing that, I mean, you start wondering why you're going to make any change at all.
Sure.
You know, and equally, I could go back and say, well, you know, why are you making a change that could have, you know, 25, 50% of the hashing power disagreeing? I mean, we've never done that ever, you know, or equally, I could go point out how, you know, I mean, just test data around Bitcoin Classic doesn't actually seem to exist. I mean, one of the things we've been looking at, for instance, is do SPU wallets actually work with this? And it doesn't look like anyone's actually tried this. You know, we don't actually have a Bitcoin testnet that actually runs on 2 megabyte blocks in a way that's, you know, being robustly tested. I mean, nobody's done, as far as I know, a 2 megabyte testnet where every block's full. You know, you're going to have to do that. I mean, I actually suggested that the switchover date should be set in the past so you can create, you know, an artificial chain and actually stress test this stuff. And that hasn't actually been done as far as we know. So you can say that a lot more testing needs to be done on both sides potentially.
I certainly, again, just as a layman, get a little nervous about rushing things that don't seem necessary to rush. I've got kind of a parallel topic. I don't know how you feel about if we talk about replace by fee a little.
Yeah, go for it.
I feel like I first heard about replaced by fee. I think Andreas was talking about it and it sounded really cool. But then later, or a few weeks ago, I should say, you executed a zero confirmation double spend using basically a Coinbase merchant account, I guess. And I guess to point out that Coinbase's wallets and other wallets weren't handling replaced by fee the way they could. Can you explain technically how a business could accept zero confirmation transactions in a replaced by fee world?
Well, keep in mind, they already have to take a heck of a lot of stuff into account. You know, for instance, the attack I've done against Coinbase, as well as other demonstrations I've done, they don't actually use the opt-in replace by fee that's being added to version 12. You know, what they actually do is much, much simpler trick, which is you simply send one transaction with a low fee and you know, wait till that shows up in the recipient's wallet or you know, your merchant says, all right, that's good, you know, hands over the goods. And then just send another transaction with a higher fee that spends the same Bitcoins.
That's a revelation to me a bit. I thought people were associating that with replace by fee. Is it just miners are just choosing the transaction they'll make more money with?
Or? Well, I mean, it's just different miners have different settings for what the minimum fee is.
Okay.
You know, not all miners accept the same minimum fee into their mempool. You know, there's really not much more to it than that. You know, it's just a natural byproduct of the fact that, you know, you've got potentially nearly unlimited amount of transactions that people might want to do. If you look at mempool, you know, nodes these days, I mean, there's hundreds of megabytes worth of junk transactions that people are trying to go push through, you know, but most of them are never going to get through because, you know, the people sending them aren't really interested in paying enough money to outbid other people. But, you know, miners are going to set their minimum fee
Can you tell me real quick, who do you think is doing these junk transactions and why then?
It's hard to know. I mean, I think a plausible theory is people just want to go show that the block size is too small, you know, by being able to say, oh, you know, mempools are full and so on. Doing that kind of attack costs you essentially nothing because these transactions don't actually confirm. 1 megabyte versus 2 doesn't really make a big difference, you know, when you look at how low fee these transactions are. Like, there's an infinite amount of stuff people would want to use Bitcoin for. You know, what this does show is that you just can't rely on all the different nodes on network having exactly the same mempool. Again, different people are going to have different settings. You know, the system is not, you know, it can't be totally reliable. You know, if I broadcast two things at once, they get to the different points in the network at different times. You know, and as people upgrade from one version of Bitcoin to another, again, the exact policies change. So, you know, anytime you are able to exploit any tiny, tiny difference like this, that is a potential opportunity to double spend zero comp transactions. Like, replaced by fee is just, the opt-in thing is the least of your worries if you're trying to actually accept zero comp, you know, with reasonable reliability.
I mean, a lot of companies use some kind of propagation measuring tools to kind of help them.
A lot of people think that's what happens, but it's not. You know, with Coinbase, for instance, when I double spent them, I mean, that was proof positive that they weren't actually doing this because I sent them a transaction with such low fee that it probably wouldn't have been mined ever. Yet, they still accepted it. I mean, I checked and it had quite poor propagation, that transaction. You know, again, they still accepted it. At the time, I've heard statements from Coinbase and many others that opt-in replaced by fee would allow double spends that you couldn't. Well, you know, it's already pretty damn easy. The opt-in thing is the least of your worries, you know, and similarly, the tests I did against various wallets, you know, you had the same thing. I mean, the reality is your wallet that you're probably using is terrible at protecting you from double spends. Absolutely terrible. Because they don't know what transaction will or will not get confirmed. And even worse, when you do get double spent, they don't show it. That's a really amazing thing to me is that, you know, you could send the majority of wallets a transaction, double spend it, and even after the double spend is confirmed and there's no way the transaction will ever get mined, the UI doesn't tell you that. You know, you go look in the wallet and it still says, yeah, waiting for confirmation. You know, you don't even know that you've been ripped off. You know, this isn't an example of people trying to make zero comp work. Yeah, this is an ecosystem where people aren't actually doing this. Anyway, point being, I think the ecosystem is very misguided view of how well this works. And, you know, opt-in replaced by fee. I mean, you put a flag in your transaction saying, hey, I might go double spend you later because I might want to update the transaction. I mean, you can't get more clear than that.
So, and I'm sorry, I didn't technically realize it's nothing more than a flag that can be monitored.
Yeah, so what actually got merged into Bitcoin Core, if you wish to replace a transaction, you have to first send the transaction with a flag saying this transaction is replaceable. And this actually goes back to the original design of version 0.1 of Bitcoin, which had this feature. And it got disabled because it had a DOS attack, which then I fixed with replace by fee. You know, so we're actually kind of coming full circle here, re-enabling something Satoshi had in day one.
I feel like based on your explanation, replaced by fees has really been erroneously vilified as some huge problem.
You know, I think this is one of those things where people who are against Bitcoin Core, you know, many of the trolls on Reddit, they use this as a way to fight back against Bitcoin Core. You know, and a lot of what was written about replaced by fee, the opt-in version was very misleading. I mean, equally, this is not a Bitcoin Core thing. You know, the rest of Bitcoin Core devs have been reasonably opposed to this, but I've worked on a full replaced by fee, right, which doesn't have any protections from zero conf. You know, there's a whole separate line of argument there. But, you know, to re-enable this feature that Satoshi had in version 0.1, I mean, that's pretty uncontroversial, and I think it's gotten a lot more flack, I think, from people who don't understand it, you know, and or are being deliberately misled, or of course are deliberately misleading people. You know, and it's kind of unfortunate this kind of happens.
Yeah, well, I was certainly under a different impression. And again, I thought your Coinbase kind of proof of the double spend was related to the replace by fee, and I was completely off, I guess. And you've changed my mind until someone smart tells me something.
Well, you know, it's I think that's a lesson learned for the whole Bitcoin Core team, is that, you know, it is really hard to get, you know, get that information out into the public and, you know, do the right kind of education to, you know, counteract the FUD that kind of comes out with stuff like this. You know, I mean, for one thing, I probably would have called it a different name. You know, I might have called it transaction replacement and pointed out how, you know, this is re-enabling one of, or for that matter, heck, Mike Hearn wanted to re-enable it too. You know, re-enabling something dating back from then. You know, unfortunately, that wasn't done too well. And, you know, I think we've also lost a lot of the nuance into, you know, what's actually capable in Bitcoin.
Today's magic word is tree chain. TREECHAIN. Enter the magic word to claim your share of this week's LTB Coin listener reward on letstalkbitcoin.com. You have 1 week from this episode's release to claim the magic word. How is your and Gavin's relationship personally?
I'd say we don't really have one.
Did you used to?
No. Gavin and I mean, I don't think we ever really got along, you know. And when I thought it was really interesting how the first time I kind of, you know, really kind of got more publicly known for the work I was doing was the earlier iterations of the block size debate. And, you know, he didn't take too kindly to, I think, a lot of the results I was coming up with. And, you know, we've never really talked to each other that much. You know, whereas I think there's many other people who I've often disagreed with, who I've friendships with, but, you know, that just hasn't happened with Gavin. I'm sure you can find plenty of examples where I've disagreed pretty strongly with Gregory Maxwell and Peter Wool and the whole host of guys, but, you know, that's not personal. And I think people tend to be fairly respectful of each other for the most part.
Are you saying it wasn't always respectful?
Unfortunately, Gavin.
Sorry?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I don't think Gavin's really been doing that. You know, whereas most other Bitcoin Core devs, I think, have been quite respectful.
So you feel he wasn't respectful even back when you guys were all working on Core together? You don't have to answer anything, by the way. I don't want to stir up a big fight. If you know, so. Just interesting.
I don't really care. I tend to be on the side of openness, you know. And also, I think, like, understanding, well, what's actually going on, you know, including this interpersonal stuff, I think that actually really helps new devs understand what they're getting into and what the dynamics are and, you know, what to expect. You know, I know if I had heard this, you know, what I'm saying right now, when I got into the space, I think I would have made better decisions and, you know, understood what was going on a lot better and, you know, being a more effective developer.
Can you explain in detail what decisions might be different and how you would be better?
You know, as an example, I mean, I think, especially if you look at my earlier writing, you know, I wasn't anywhere near careful enough in how I wrote. And, you know, I wasn't thinking about how people were taking my words, you know, especially because, I mean, remember at the time I'd just come from, I should say at the time I was still working at a very tight-knit startup, you know, where every single person you work with, you're working with in person, you know them well, you know, you've got all that, the physical interaction where, you know, you can get a much better sense of what they're actually thinking. And equally, that startup, I think, was a bit unusual because a lot of the stuff we were involved with was, you know, safety related. And the standards for that tend to be very high. You know, I remember on my first week on the job, my boss told me, you know, if you screw up ever, I immediately want to hear about it. Because you might be doing something which could be dangerous and, you know, could lead to an accident. You know, I mean, there's no fault here. I want to go hear what happens, and I want you to be honest with me. And equally, you know, within the first month, of course, the flip side of that was, well, if you think somebody else is doing something wrong, you know, if you think there's something that needs to be changed, what they're doing, you think their design is incorrect, whatever, you should speak up. You know, it doesn't matter that your job title is junior, you know, electronics technician, a cable assembler. You know, if you think the CEO is doing something wrong, you should say so. And I did. you know, and everyone at the company did. And that kind of openness worked really well. Of course, it's hard to implement on the online. You know, it's much easier to do when you're in person. It's a small team. You all know each other very well. You know, and I think I made a lot of mistakes early on. Coming from that environment and not realizing what other people were thinking.
Programming mistakes or social mistakes? What kind of mistake?
Oh, social, you know, as in like how you talk to people, how your words come across, you know, what you can go say to people, how you should frame it. You know, it's a completely different style of communication than I was used to, you know. Yet, some aspects of it were very similar. You know, both Bitcoin in that job, there's very high consequences if you screw up. You know, and I think I saw that very quickly in Bitcoin and applied that same kind of thinking. And, you know, it's often called adversarial thinking. You know, how could this break?
Sure. Wow. Man, I could keep asking you questions forever. How are you feeling on time?
I'm fine.
Where did you grow up?
Oh, in Toronto.
And is that where you still are?
Yep.
Is that where your previous job was also?
Yep. About 15 minutes away.
And so do you do things like attend, say, local meetups?
I do, actually. In fact, I even speak at them every once in a while.
That must be quite exciting.
Well, you know, it's interesting thinking back, like how much it's grown. I mean, I remember once, you know, giving a talk, well, probably would have been 2013 maybe, where literally no one other than the organizer and like one of my friends showed up, you know. And then like a year later, you know, I'm speaking to groups of like 200, 300, 400 people. You know, it was quite a rapid change there.
Do you travel much or go to conferences much?
I travel a ridiculous amount.
Do you go to a lot of conferences or where are you going?
Yeah, I get invited to a lot of stuff. You know, I end up traveling to visit to clients and whatnot. You know, I mean, not that long ago, I would have spent about 2 months straight out of my apartment, you know, because I went to China to go visit various mining stuff, went to the Hong Kong Scaling Bitcoin Conference, you know, went off to, after that, to go visit family for a bit, you know, then went off to Victoria to go meet up with some people, San Francisco, you know, New York, and then finally Boston before I finally went home. So it was quite the trip and not the only time I've done that.
I did not realize you were so like on the scene and hands-on. I just pictured you held up in wherever you are, coding and stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, I think some people do that more than others. I mean, I think most of what I've done in this space hasn't been direct coding and so on, but rather, you know, helping other people do interesting work. You know, most of my consulting is not me writing code. It's me advising companies and advising teams on, you know, what they should do, you know, what they should look out for, where they can go next. You know, equally like when I was in Boston last, I mean, that was to spend a week at MIT, you know, talking with students and giving them advice on their projects and vice versa. And, you know, did some talks and whatnot. I mean, I don't think I wrote a single line of code there, but I thought it was very productive.
What's it cost about to consult with a core developer on a Bitcoin project?
Me personally, I go charge based on whether or not the client wants an NDA and, you know, the usual stuff. I pretty much double my prices for NDAs. And, you know, if it's open source work that I think's in the public interest and so on, I tend to charge about $150 an hour, build like a lawyer does, no breaks and whatnot. You know, and I think there's a lot of different models. I mean, I've, you know, seen offers where, you know, people just pay like a flat retainer by the month or so on. You know, there's full-time stuff. I think Gavin's paid, for instance, roughly $150,000 a year, if I remember, you know, as a straight salary. I mean, you know, there's a lot of different models there. For me personally, I try to go structure things where I'm not dependent on one client. You know, I'd much rather, you know, maintain some independence.
Are there particular projects you feel you've been fairly involved in?
I mean, Bitcoin Core, definitely.
Oh, I'm sorry. Beyond Bitcoin Core, I mean... Oh. I've seen your name tied to various projects. Like, I just, for the first time, noticed just the other day that you were somehow involved with MasterCoin.
Yeah. You know, and I think that's a good example of how a lot of that stuff's gone, where, you know, MasterCoin heard about me, as far as I can tell, about me going and, you know, essentially saying I didn't think their system would work. You know, I think it was quite flawed, et cetera, et cetera.
What were the flaws?
at the time, I mean, you know, there's a lot of debate about putting extra data in the blockchain, and uh-huh. the way they'd done it was very prone to censorship and fairly inefficient.
Hmm.
You know, as in the sense that miners could go censor it. And, you know, to MasterCoin's credit, they actually went and hired me as chief scientist. And my job was essentially to do research and figure out where could, you know, the next iteration of MasterCoin go. So funny enough, I never really worked on MasterCoin directly, but I did a lot of research and understanding, you know, how do these systems work? I mean, what options do they have to resist censorship, you know?
What was the actual change that had to be made?
Well, there's a lot of stuff. And I think MasterCoin 1.0, if you will, you know, there wasn't actually a good way to upgrade it to the point where it would have these flaws fixed. You know, on the other hand, I think that research led to a lot of useful long-term stuff. And, you know, that eventually led to my work on tree chains and client-side validation and, you know, a bunch more things along those lines. So I'm happy with where the research goes. Didn't necessarily help MasterCoin, but did help the ecosystem as a whole.
So you feel things like MasterCoin or Counterparty right now are in a more secure state as far as not being censorable, the transaction data?
No, I don't think so. I think mainly what's happened is the politics around that have kind of changed a bit.
It's just become more acceptable to have this data in the transaction?
Yeah. And I think also having the ability to move to systems that are more censorship resistant often changes the discussion, because it means that if you try to censor stuff, you know, you'll fail anyway. So why bother in the first place?
Do you have a personal opinion about these projects that add a layer on top of Bitcoin?
Now, keep in mind, in this particular thing, you're actually embedding the data right into the blockchain.
Sure. That's, I guess, specifically what I'm trying to ask you about. Yeah, how you feel about that?
I'm very sympathetic to people who think this is damaging to Bitcoin and, you know, this is, you know, spam on the blockchain and so on. I mean, I think from their point of view, they're right. You know, I think they have a valid argument. But you also got to look at it from the point of view of the people creating these systems. You know, in particular, the fact that given that censorship-resistant technology is available, you're not going to stop them. So really, you're better off designing the whole, you know, the system as a whole, that is Bitcoin, to take into account the fact that people will use a blockchain for stuff you didn't intend them to. And, you know, then that kind of gets back to scalability. You know, if the system actually scales, this is less of an issue. If the system doesn't scale, you know, you're directly competing with between those two use cases, you know, Bitcoin, the currency, and then all these non-Bitcoin consensus systems that would love to use the blockchain. You know, I think also that's very closely related to block size, because after all, you know, potential space of things that could use a blockchain is infinite. You know, Jeff Garzik's work, for instance, with fintech stuff. I've been to his presentations where he talks about all these great things in front of bankers, you know, that you could use Bitcoin for, and how you can go and link your non-Bitcoin transaction systems to the blockchain to better secure them. I mean, that's all great tech, but, you know, that's using up Bitcoin capacity, and you'll create a conflict there.
Do you have any thoughts on private blockchains in general, their usefulness and their security?
Well, keep in mind, I mean, I was an advisor to R3 for something like 6 months, so I've actually done a fair bit of work understanding these systems, and, you know, I'd make the point that I think, especially with what we are seeing right now, a lot of them are essentially databases with better ways of showing that the state of the database is correct. You know, essentially, it's an audit log for databases. And I think, you know, the implementations I'm seeing, I think a lot of them aren't getting the benefits that you could. You know, given how poorly blockchains actually scale as a data structure, you know, I think there's much better ways to do these kind of systems. And I expect to see, you know, the kind of the next generation after the experiments we're seeing right now start implementing those concepts. Of course, you know, I've done a lot of work on where you can go next with this. You know, my proof chains work is an example, which I, you know, did for multiple clients. And I'm actually working on a paper right now on calling it kind of modularized validation, with the idea that you'll take, you know, your validation function that says whether or not a block is valid or invalid, and then split it up so you can get much more fine-grained tests for whether something is or isn't valid. Well, in the context of a private chain, that means you spread the load over many more systems, you know, and potentially have a system that's actually getting you something more than just a database, you know, where you can actually say, yes, you know, from this guy's desk to that guy's desk, we really do have a full tamper-resistant log that actually shows that the thing that happened in the way it should have. You know, and currently we don't tend to have that. Currently we kind of have some trusted servers running some private chains, and ultimately the sysadmins on the servers are the ones who control the system. And that's kind of looking like just big database. You know, I'm not sure that's really where the advantage of this tech is. But, you know, equally I'd point out, like, I think the Bitcoin people, for them to just dismiss this stuff, you know, I think they're missing this point too. You know, I mean, there's many banking applications where we're always going to involve some trust. You know, it's not to go say that you're going to instantly decentralize the stuff or replace all the banks. I mean, we're not going to write a smart contract that can evaluate whether or not someone's a, you know, good loan risk. You're going to have humans in the loop there. You know, can you go automate other parts of that? Sure. But because it's got tied back to this trusted entity, you know, you're probably going to end up with something closer to a private chain rather than, you know, putting this on the public blockchain, even if it's scaled. So room for both.
I saw both you and Gavin listed as going to the Satoshi Roundtable coming up later this month. Are you still going?
Yes, I will be there. Actually, I just booked my tickets last night.
Will it be uncomfortable to be in the room with Gavin, or how will that go?
It doesn't bother me. It's just not necessarily as productive as it could be. You know, and I think, unfortunately, the scaling Bitcoin, particularly, you know, the Hong Kong one, didn't have this, which is to get, you know, a wide spectrum of people across industry, not just miners. Go talk to core devs, and you know, I'll be there, Madden Back will be there, Matt Carallo will be there, Luke Jr. will be there, maybe a few others, although I don't want to promise anything yet. But, you know, I think it would be a good opportunity for, you know, these people to go talk to all the people in the industry, not just miners. And it was also kind of a disappointment not seeing, for instance, you know, Coinbase be represented at Scaling Bitcoin or BitPay or, you know, any of those people. So, like, you know, that needs to happen, so.
Okay, so you're looking forward to it?
I mean, it'll be interesting.
Is it work or is it fun?
Well, I mean, this job's kind of fun, but it's also kind of work.
I don't know why I thought half of it was just kind of having fun. Just
I don't think I've ever been to a so-called for fun conference that was Bitcoin related where I spent much of my time not talking to people. You know, I mean, when you're in an environment like that, I mean, you're not going to miss that opportunity. You know, you might as well, you know, use opportunity to its best advantage, and, you know.
I guess I'm picturing you talking in a pool with drinks in your hands or something.
I mean, that happens, but it is a valuable discussion all the same.
What do you see in the future? Let's say, where do you think Bitcoin will be in 1 year or 5 years? You have any just wild ideas?
I mean, I think in 1 year, it's probably going to look roughly the same as it is. You know, I think we'll probably be seeing people, you know, using things like the Lightning Network. You know, I got to admit, 21 as an example, they're doing some really interesting stuff with micropayment channels and, you know, actually deploying stuff that actually works and, you know, moves money around cheaply.
So do you feel the current 21 computer is just kind of almost a proof of concept and not really supposed to be some serious, like, hey, this is a big deal? It's just kind of working to some bigger end, or?
I've had some discussions with them directly, so I might go bite my tongue a bit on where it might end up in the end, but I will say that the micropayment stuff is quite interesting. You know, what their actual business plan is, well, I may have some info that other people don't, so.
I feel like they're up to something, and a lot of people write them off, but I think maybe they have a longer game than people are visualizing is my sense, but.
I was convinced that they're quite smart people. Maybe a bit crazy, but they definitely are smart people.
Do you want to throw out anything for 5 or 10 years or?
So my guess, and I'll say this is kind of my vision for these systems. I often kind of describe this in terms of the telephone and the internet, which is, well, when you look at how did telephone system work? You have this really, really dumb box with a handset and a dial. And all the intelligence of the system was in the middle. You know, you had this massively complex telecom infrastructure, you know, and even simple things like, well, what if I want caller ID? Oh, better if the telephone company implement it. You know, what if I want a voicemail functionality? Well, let's go get the telephone company to implement it. You know, pushing all this logic to the middle. And then look at the internet, you know, which did the exact opposite. Internet routers are really dumb. All they do is they move packets from point A to point B. You know, they don't look at the contents of packets. For the most part, you know, they just do something very, very simple. And all the intelligence is at the edges. Well, you know, when you look at how we're using blockchain stuff, I mean, even this whole debate about how do we have governance over the Bitcoin protocol, that implies that all the logic's in the middle. You know, that implies we have this really clever system that does a lot of things, and the clients are kind of dumb. You know, when you look at SPV wallets, they don't verify anything. Well, you know, all they do is they just blindly trust hashing power. And I don't think that system actually works. I don't think it's sustainable. I don't think, you know, it's works socially. You know, I'm not sure it works politically. You get into these debates over, you know, how are we going to change this feature, change that feature, et cetera. You know, most of my research has been, well, how do we have a dumber middle, you know, something that's closer to just pure ledger, and then put intelligence at the edges? You know, and in such a system, for instance, you know, my tree chains ideas are an example of this. You know, all miners might do is essentially timestamp and prove the publication of data. You know, my client would then be doing all the work of examining that data, validating that data, et cetera. And provided you can make that process fast enough and efficient enough, you know, this is a potentially much better system, because the dumber miners are, the more of them you can go throw at one problem, you know, and the easier it is to split up that problem. So in 10 years, you know, I don't think we're going to have a block size debate. And I don't think we're going to have a debate about what features we add to Bitcoin. You know, the Bitcoin blockchain is just going to be this incredibly dumb thing. Like, it's used for a ton of different stuff. You know, some Bitcoin, some non-Bitcoin. Banks will probably use it to secure their private chains, whatever. You know, and hopefully this will all coexist in much the same way that different applications on the internet coexist, you know, yet still all contribute to the functioning of the same system. So, I don't know, maybe give it 10 years, hopefully 5.
That's neat to think about it that way.
Yeah.
Are there websites or different ways people should get a hold of you or see what you're writing about?
Well, I actually now have a website again, finally. It's very hard to remember the URL, https://petertodd.org. And I've published some stuff on various Bitcoin-related things, and we'll have more up there soon.
Great. Well, thanks so much for talking to me.
Yeah, you're welcome. Bitcoin.
How fun was that? Check out this episode's show notes page, where you'll find a long list of links to topics we discussed. It's also a great place to leave a comment or ask a question. You can find the show notes page by going to thebitcoingame.com and look for episode 34 with Peter Todd. On Twitter, I'm the BTC Game. See you next time.